This is Steve Maxner conducting an oral history interview with Judge Herbert Green on the 9th of May, year 2000, in the Special Collections Library interview room at 3:10 in the afternoon. Judge Green, would you begin, please, by giving a brief biographical sketch of yourself?
Well, I was born in New York in December 1941. And I basically grew up there. I went through school, high school there, and went to college at Queens College in New York. And then I went to law school at the University of Texas. And from there, I came in the Army. I left school in June of 66 and went to Washington to work for the Federal Communications Commission, worked there for 3 months or so, and then came in the Army in October of 1966.
Okay.
And basically just stayed.
And that was, you voluntarily went into the Army?
Well, back then, it was a choice of poison. Because you had the draft, and there were no numbers where you had, you know, if you got a high or low number, you had a better chance. It wasn't like that. It was, if you were a warm body, your draft board took you. So you had really planned on coming into service. Now, whether you were going in as a draftee, or you enlisted, or you got a commission as an officer, there were various choices, but one of the you were going to be on one of those tracks. Mm-hmm. So my senior year in law school, I guess, I started talking to the Army, and actually I talked to Army and the Air Force. Mm-hmm. And the Army accepted me right away, depending on the bar results. I took the bar exam in June, and the results don't come out usually till, well, then they didn't come out till late August, early September. Mm-hmm. No, it had been September, and the way it worked is I had a class, a basic class starting probably the end of September, and it didn't look like I could make that class because of the bar results. Then my draft board got involved, and they said, well, we're going to draft you anyhow. And I wrote them. I said, you know, I'm going to the Army for 4 years. And they said, you know, basically, we don't care. We have a quota, and you're a body, and you match. And so I called the Army back, and I said, what can I do? And I remember I talked to Charlie White, who was in the career management office, and he said, can you come in 20 days? I said, sure. So I did. And so in those days, the basic class of the JAG Corps was, you had two phases. You had a 2 or 3 week phase at Fort Lee where you got oriented to the Army, and then you had a 10 or 12 week phase at Charlottesville where the Judge Advocate General School is, and you go through the class and learn about military law. Mm-hmm. And so I missed the first phase, and I went straight to Charlottesville. In fact, I had this telegram. It was about a 13-page telegram. And I showed up at Charlottesville, and there was nobody from the class was there yet. It was on a Thursday, the 13th of October, and they were coming in on the 14th. So I turned in this telegram. They go say, I didn't know anything about the Army. I mean, nothing. Gave him a telegram, and he said, well, who are you? I said, hey, here, that's all I know. So I gave him a telegram, and then about an hour later, he gave me a card. That was the oath of office, the oath that an officer takes. Mm-hmm. He said, sign it, and I took a minute to read it. He looked a little disconcerted that somebody would actually read it, but I signed it and sworn in, so that's how I became an officer in the Army. So it wasn't, you know, so when you say volunteer, mm-hmm. Yeah, I volunteered, but I had, at that point, no intention of staying in the Army any longer than I had to. Mm-hmm. I was doing it basically to beat the draft at that time.
Mm-hmm. And if you had been drafted, you could have been thrown anywhere.
Oh, I'd have been a enlisted guy, and probably, I guess. Yeah. Or, well, who knows what. But,
Okay. So you, when you arrived at Charlottesville, you didn't even have uniforms or anything.
Well, I did. What I did is this Charlie White, when I talked to him, I said, well, what do I need? And he told me the type of uniforms I should buy, and I had gone over to the quartermaster sales store at Fort Myer, Virginia, because I was working in Washington then, just across the river, and he gave me a list of things to buy, and I bought them. But I had the uniforms that I could that I needed there. It wasn't much because I didn't really need all that much down there. The basic green uniform, and then what I did, they had to send me to Fort Lee anyhow for a day, so I went down and told me to buy a blue uniform, so I bought that. But that was basically what I had, but not much else.
So what was the regiment at Charlottesville like?
Charlottesville was just like going to school, only it was longer hours. I can't recall exactly what it was then, but we went 5 days in a week, and we went about half a day on about half the Saturdays. Mm-hmm. And they taught us, what we called in those days, we probably had a few hours of claims law and a few hours of international law, but the bulk of it was what they called military affairs and military criminal law. And military affairs is basically all the ash and trash and that doesn't come in some other category, all types of law involving, say, personnel eliminations, all kinds of law related to that. And then, of course, I guess probably half the class or half the time was criminal law, because that's what we did mainly in those days. Some claims, some we called legal assistance, personal legal affairs of the individual. Mm-hmm. But basically, the large part was criminal law.
By personal legal affairs, you mean things like powers of attorney,
wills,
wills, divorce,
soldiers and sailors, civil Relief Act problems. You have a lot of soldiers, especially then, because the Army was so big, being separated from home, and you have all the things that arise out of that. So they taught us a lot about that.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you talk about criminal law, you're talking about studying the Uniform Code of Military Justice.
That's right.
And other aspects of criminal law, like Article 32 investigations and things like that, or?
Well, that's all part of the Uniform Code is an amazing document. I spent my whole life working with it. But it's an amazing document because it sets up a lot of different procedures, as well as sets out the criminal statutes, the crimes. Mm-hmm. The Article 32 is Article 32 of the Code, and that creates what that article basically provides is that before you can have a general court-martial, you have to have an investigation, which is required by that article in the Code. And then, the Code gives the President the authority to create procedural rules, and he's done that in the manual for courts martial. So the Code is really a small document. The manual is a massive document, and so they taught us the manual as well. That's where we spent. That's where the guts of the actual military criminal law reside.
Now, did you know when you got to Charlottesville that you would be going to Vietnam?
No, but expected it. Mm-hmm. Most of us expected in those days that we would go to Vietnam, and an awful lot of my classmates did go to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. I don't think we thought about it then. I had my when I got there, I had my assignment to go to Fort Sam Houston. That was my first assignment. Mm-hmm. Back then, they did not send anybody directly from the basic course to to Vietnam.
Oh, okay.
So I knew I wasn't going right away, and because I was a direct commission and not a ROTC graduate, they sent me to other schooling as well. When I left Charlottesville, I didn't go to Fort Sam. I went to Fort Knox. There were about 15 of us. And we went to Fort Knox to go through the Armor Officers Basic Course, which was a fun thing to do. I mean, it was interesting. It was probably a waste of time, but the theory was good to have us learn more about the Army. As it is, I learned a little about tanks, and that helped me later on, I guess. I mean, when I dealt with armor officer personnel. But so I didn't know where I was going, but I expected I would go to Vietnam, or I thought that that was a good possibility.
Mm-hmm. Now, were you branched JAG, or were you branched armor?
No, I was a JAG. What they did is they just took us, like I said, about 15 of us, and they sent us out there. But we had a JAG branch, and we were members of the Judge Advocate General's Corps. We were just taking a 10-week vacation in the winter in Kentucky. And basically, that's what we did. We got there in early January and stayed till early March. Mm-hmm. And then we finally got to our duty stations.
Okay. The training at Charlottesville, did you think that was effective in preparing you to be a JAG officer? Especially once you got to your follow-on station at Fort St. Houston, and became a JAG officer.
It wasn't too good then. It was okay, but it wasn't great. I was fortunate enough later in my career to go back to Charlottesville to be the chief of the Criminal Law Division. And one of the things I concentrated on heavily was the basic course. It gave me some flavor, but it was like the old drinking out of a fire hose. Mm-hmm. They threw so much at us, and I had, since I had no real background to understand military law and the military, it was a lot that went by me, and I couldn't put a lot of the information. I got a lot of information, but I didn't know where to put it. I got a little bit out of it. I mean, it wasn't bad, and it could have been a lot better, and that's what I strive to do when I got back there 15 or so years later, to make it better. I'll give you an example. What I did when I got back to Charlottesville as the chief of Criminal Law Division in 1979, one of the first things I did in the basic course is I taught about the first 15 minutes of when we got the class to the criminal law section of the course, which was in those days the last half of the course. And I went in with the whole class, on every basic class. And I had them bring the manual of course martial in there because that has the code in it in the Constitution. And the first thing I did is I had them open up the manual, turn to the Constitution, and I showed them Article 1, Section 8, which says that Congress has the power to create the law, the rules that govern the land and naval forces. And I pointed that out to them. I said, all right, now this is the start of military law. This is where it all comes from. Mm-hmm. And then I showed them the code, and I said, okay, Congress has done that by enacting the code. And this is a law. You know, this is an actual law by Congress. And then I showed them Article 36 of the code, which says the president has the power to promulgate the procedural rules. And I said, he's done that. And that's the manual. I did that for a reason, because I felt that I never got that background, that foundation when I was in the basic class. Got a lot thrown at me, but I never got the perspective of where it was. Vince Lombardi used to start every practice with the Packers, every spring summer training by saying, gentlemen, this is football. And I want to do the same thing. Start at ground zero and work from there. Okay. So that's what I started. And what I also did, I concentrated a lot more on practical exercises at the basic course. I had my guys create some what we call trial techniques, how lawyers do certain things, how they handle certain pieces of evidence, how they could impeach a witness by a prior inconsistent statement or something like that. We had them working hard when I was there, but because we had them working long hours because we were doing all these practical things. Mm-hmm. We taught them the law, but we also taught them how to do things, because I wanted them to at least, when they got to their duty stations, I wanted them to be able to get into a courtroom and at least feel, maybe not comfortable, but at least it would look familiar to them, or understand what was going on.
Okay.
So I guess a lot of that was a reaction to the basic course that I didn't think was as good as it could have been, although some of the teachers were really good. I mean, really good teachers, in fact, when I was there. Just that the, I don't know, maybe it was me, and maybe I was at sea, because I hadn't had a military training of any kind.
Did the practical training that you instituted in Charlottesville when you went through the basic course, did you have mock trials?
Yeah. Okay. We had, what I created was, we had a guilty plea mock trial, and we had a not guilty plea mock trial. That was already there. I strengthened these trial techniques, how to do certain things. Mm-hmm. Also, I think we had a confessions exercise, how to get a confession in evidence. Mm-hmm. I also had them do a search and seizure exercise, how to do that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I added a lot to what we had, and I structured, put emphasis on these trial, on these practical exercises.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because that's not what, when I was there in Charlottesville, I think the only thing we had was one trial.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, none of these other things.
Okay.
It was just maybe lectures.
Did you get feedback from your students on the stuff that you introduced and whether or not they felt it was helpful?
Oh, yeah. Well, we gave them critiques, and we got them, we took a look at them, and, you know, and what they said. Some of them didn't like the way we did it. We were hard on them. I got so much criticism, it was amazing, and I used to laugh because, you know, my feeling was that in a couple of weeks or a couple of months, these guys are going to go into a courtroom. They're going to have an SOB like me for judge, and they better have their act together.
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, I guess I'll digress. I remember after I'd been in Charlottesville, I was assigned as a staff judge advocate. And the phone rang one day about 6 o'clock. I was the only one there, so I answered it. It was some JAG captain calling, and I mentioned my name. He said, "Oh, yeah, you were my judge in moot court in Charlottesville." I said, "Oh, yeah." He said, "You know, I've dry cleaned my uniform 4 times. I still can't get the sweat stains out." But I felt that was good because that's what I wanted him.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I wanted him to feel. So he would be, he'd have his act together when he got into real court.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The move from Charlottesville to Armor School. Now, when you arrived at Armor School, how did they greet you? Here you're a JAG officer coming to Fort Knox.
Yeah.
I mean, how did they treat you?
I'll tell you what happened. We had we were assigned to a detachment. I don't know how many were in the class, maybe 100. Probably about 100 students all together. And it was Captain Brown was the detachment commander, and called the 15 JAG officers into his office. Now, we're all captains.
Mm-hmm.
He says, "Listen, you guys, I know you're JAG officers. I know you're not here to learn armor. Just don't screw up the class for the guys who are. You'll stand in the back. You just don't make a mess of this training." And we didn't. I mean, mm-hmm. We sort of took it seriously, but we didn't take it seriously. We didn't interfere with his work because we knew for these guys it was life or death.
Mm-hmm.
But then we enjoyed riding on the tanks and shooting the mortars and shooting the tank guns at the stationary ranges and doing the exercises, the night map exercise and stuff like that. I mean, we enjoyed that.
Mm-hmm.
Classes were awful, but so we just kept out of their way and treated them with respect and And it was great. It really was great.
How did the other armor branch students act towards you, knowing that you're only there because they made some decision to send jag ushers through?
I think we had mutual respect among, you know, like I said, we didn't interfere with their training. We knew that for them it was deadly serious. Mm-hmm. They knew for us it wasn't, but they saw our enthusiasm. I mean, we actually, you know, we participated. Mm-hmm. We crawled under the wire and we did everything, so we weren't special in that regard. And so we had a lot of fun together, mm-hmm. really.
Did armor school... What was the most important thing you took away from armor school, whether it was an immediate benefit or something that was important later on?
Oh, maybe understanding the language of armor, and understanding what armor does, and armor is more than just an artillery piece. And it's the shoot, move, and communicate. And that was, I guess, learning about the armor branch, really, and how they did their business.
Did that help you relate to other, not just armor officer, but other combat arms personnel later on in your career?
Maybe to the armor people. Like in Vietnam, I did a lot of work with the 11th Cav, and in Germany, I worked a lot with the 2nd Cav, some armor people as well. Of course, when I was in the division, we had a lot of armor personnel. I could talk to them, but not as much as you might think.
Okay.
Of course, by that time, I was a little more mature. I understood the Army a little better.
So you went from Fort Knox to Fort Sam Houston, Texas.
That's right. That
what,
was my...
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, what unit were you assigned to?
Well, that was my first assignment. I was assigned to the post... JAG office. In those days at Fort Sam, you had you had several offices. You had the 4th, and then it was 4th Army headquarters, and they were located on Fort Sam. Mm-hmm. I was assigned to the post headquarters, the commander, U.S. Army garrison, Fort Sam. Mm-hmm. And we had the post staff judge advocate office. Actually, it was the post judge advocate office. Then there was Brooke Army Medical Center had its own judge advocate, and I think there may have been a judge advocate teaching in the medical field service school. I can't recall that exactly. But so we had at least 3 and maybe 4 JAG offices on post, and mm-hmm. I was in the installation JAG office.
Okay. What particular was it? By being in the post JAG office, did it support all of the major units on post, or just...
The major units, other than Army headquarters and the hospital and that, were the U.S. Army, the medical training center.
Mm-hmm.
The medical training center trained all the corpsmen. The medical field service school trained the officers, so they trained the doctors and mm-hmm. the nurses and other medical officer types. The service school, I don't know if it came under the garrison or not. I'm not sure it did, but we had very little dealings with them. We dealt with the medical training center. It was the main unit who we worked with, other than the garrison headquarters company and the MPs and stuff like that. And we've got a pretty small office. We had a lieutenant colonel who was the JA, and then there were, Gene Powell and Harold Nathan and myself were 3 captains, and then a couple months later, Mike Fletcher came in as another captain, and we had an enlisted man who was a lawyer. He was drafted, see?
Oh.
So he was working there, and he did our legal assistance and stuff. And he didn't do all legal assistance. Harold Nathan was in charge of that. Mm-hmm. I did a little bit of everything. And we had a real small office.
Mm-hmm. Did you do a lot of trial work there?
Not a lot, but we had... we were a special court jurisdiction, so we couldn't try general courts. Mm-hmm. That was Army, and Army did 1 in the 9 months I was there, so it wasn't a big deal. Mm-hmm. What we had at Fort Sam is, like I said, we trained the corpsmen, And, you know, conscientious objectors came in two categories back then. You had those who were exempt from military service, mm-hmm. and those who were brought into the service but given duties consistent with their beliefs. Well, we had a number of conscientious objectors who were in the Army who believed that their beliefs really exempted them from all military service, and they believed they were drafted improperly. Mm-hmm. And from time to time, we had one who refused orders or refused to do something or did something incompatible with military service, and so we wound up trying these guys for willful disobedience. It was usually, best I can recall, gosh, we're going back a lot of years, mm-hmm. About the fifth week of training, they were given a rifle, and that's when push came to shove, and they refused to fire the rifle, and then they were given orders to fire, and then we went, and they refused, and we wound up in a court-martial. And I think I defended several, and I prosecuted one or two in there. It was always a special court-martial, and it was almost, there wasn't much you could do. The evidence was pretty clear, and if when you're defending, because maximum punishment was 6 months confinement, 6 months forfeiture of two-thirds pay, mm-hmm. what we called six and six. And I once got up to court and I argued, I said, gentlemen, you gotta know there are other numbers except six and six. And I think they gave the guy five and six. You know, it was a moral victory. But there really wasn't much that you could do. I mean, mm-hmm. we were stuck. The draft boards put them in the Army. The service regulations provided that those in the Army who felt that they belonged out of the Army, felt they were wronged by the draft board, could appeal, go through an administrative procedure. The problem was that when that got to a certain level above the post level, probably Washington, they sent it over to the selective service system. And the selective service system decided that they made a mistake. Well, needless to say, that was a useless exercise. And this is all, well, this is 1967, so this is before the major anti-war activities, before federal courts might be more willing to give habeas corpus relief and things like that. It was pretty tough on these guys who, some of them probably legitimately did not belong in the Army. I mean, legally didn't belong in the Army, but they were there anyway. So that's basically the kind of work that we did, a lot of work with conscientious objector issues. I had other courts martial. I prosecuted and defended probably some thieves and some other type of stuff. But it wasn't anything real significant.
Okay. The conscientious objectors in those court martials, to your knowledge, did that remain the punishment or the you mentioned, for instance, in the question of it, one of the things that happened during the course of your stay in Vietnam was when you first got to Vietnam, prosecution for drug offense was a court martial. When you left, it was an Article 15. And I was wondering if a similar change occurred with conscientious objectors.
Not the time I was there. My boss, the JA, the post judge advocate, had a rule that after trial he would call the individual in his office, and if the individual had promised to go back to being a soldier, we would suspend his sentence, because we don't want these guys in jail. I mean, we want them being soldiers. I mean, you know, the Army, the institution.
Yeah.
And it's funny, you know, and then once I remember, guys, sorry, Colonel, can't do that. The guy went off to jail. About 2 days later, he calls us. Hey, I found a place in the Bible, it says I can do it. So we took him out, and he was a soldier again. I don't think, well, the time I was there, the policy didn't change. But, you know, it couldn't, because you had to have it. You had to have that legal coercion to get soldiers to do soldier jobs and soldier work. Because you're fighting a war. You know, and so you have to do things like that that you might not do other times. AWOL during that time was pretty serious. AWOL in peacetime is really not as serious. Of course, it isn't as plentiful either. So,
how would AWOLs be handled?
Well, probably the best example, I tell you, 1969, I was a military judge at Fort Gordon, Georgia. And in those days, we had they changed the name every couple of months, but called the Special Processing Detachment. And many of the installations would pick up these soldiers who were AWOL. And we had since I was at Gordon, they had, Gordon was responsible for the AWOLs in the southeast. And every week they'd send a bus to Florida, stopping at various places and picking up the AWOLs who'd been apprehended. That was called the Gator Run. Mm-hmm. And they'd send another bus up in Tennessee and North Georgia and pick up all the people up there and bring them down. And most of them were tried by regular special court-martial. I used to do, I remember, 2 days a week I'd go over and try the AWOL cases. And we'd try anything from 10 to 15 cases a day. Mm-hmm. And they'd come in and they'd say, you know, they'd give me one story or another, none of which was legally a defense. And I'd send them to jail for 2 to 5 months, depending. And those days, the Army had the Army Retraining Brigade at Fort Riley, Kansas. That was a way of getting soldiers back to duty. Mm-hmm. So a lot of them would come in and say, I want to go to the Retraining Brigade. And I'd say, well, you know, I got to sentence you to X amount of time in jail to do that. And they said, yeah, I said, okay. You know, and I'd give them 3 or 4 months, and they'd go off to Fort Riley. That's how they did it there. Other installations probably tried them by general court-martial. Or BCD special, because you know, I guess the command feeling was you had to give them a reason to stay around. Mm-hmm. You know, you had to make the price real high in order to you had to have an army. You know, the whole army goes, hey, well, that time. Okay. So that's how they did it there. Then they had other, but they did try a lot of general courts there. So. At Gordon, so that they must have made a distinction between desertion. Of course, a lot of this was desertion that they're trying as AWOL, but I guess they made their own choices on why some people went by special court and one by general court. It could have been the length of the AWOL, or it could have been some other reasons.
Okay. Question back to the conscientious objectors.
Yeah.
Did many of them, or did all of them, take the judge advocate up on his offer if they go back to soldiering that he would suspend their sentence?
No. They went to jail. In fact, it was the exception.
It was the exception.
They went to jail. They got a 6-month sentence. They served 5 months. And then they'd come back. And then we'd go through the drill again 2 or 3 times. Yeah.
So there was a lot of guys that would stick to it. They wouldn't give in.
Some of these people were I'm not going to give you a percentage how many, but a lot of them were honest. They were sincere. They shouldn't have been drafted in the first place. They were wronged. They were absolutely, you know, they were wronged by their government.
What did you and your fellow staff sergeants think about that? That particular predicament in particular?
We didn't like it. I didn't like it. But we were hamstrung. I mean, there's nothing much that we could do about it. We were sworn to follow the law. I mean, look, you couldn't go into a court-martial and argue the guy's illegally in the Army because this was wrong and that was wrong. You probably couldn't even get that into evidence. And so you just brought up their sincerity and hoped that the members of the court would give them a more lenient sentence based on it, or the command really wouldn't listen either. They would tell you to follow the admin procedures, and you did that, and of course it. But like I said, then when the selective service system got in there, and it was very frustrating for us, and we were not happy with it. We were considerably unhappy with it.
And there was no higher appeal authority than the selective service to determine whether or not a person was...
Well, eventually, probably some organizations represented these claimants in federal court. Now, I remember in 69 in Fort Gordon, they would have these habeas corpus petitions then, but as I recall, that wasn't... Back there, it wasn't successful. Maybe in other parts of the country, it may have been more successful.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I imagine San Francisco, you had a better chance of getting a habeas corpus petition through a federal court than you would in Georgia.
And what did you and your fellow officers talk about with regard to what was going on in Vietnam?
67, it was still a good war. I volunteered to go to Vietnam. I called probably in June, July, called career management and told them I wanted to go to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
We felt, well, I won't say we, I think the prevailing view among the officers was that it was a good war, we were doing the right thing, there were important national issues, that national interests involved. The domino theory was alive and well. Basically, it was a place to go. I mean, what we were doing was right, and we should serve over there because we were serving the interests of our country over there in a just cause.
What about from the standpoint of your international law training?
My international law training was like about 2 or 3 hours. I mean, I thought you saw that,
right,
but it wasn't
right,
much.
Right.
That had... Back then... there was nothing in international law that I related to that. I mean, it was mainly the political side of it, the geopolitics, the communists and us, and the free world and the communist world. And that. I can't think of anything that was of significance.
Okay. Do you remember... while you were still at Fort Sam Houston before you went to Vietnam, when General Westmoreland came back to the United States and made his, I guess he made some speeches and stuff in Congress, and it was in late 67 that he made that rather infamous comment to Congress that the light was at the end of the tunnel, we would win in Vietnam shortly.
Well, I don't remember... If I remember those comments at the time, sometime after that, those comments took on everything in 66 and 67 took on a different light in 68 and 69.
Mm-hmm.
While we were living through 67, it was still... They were starting to get the discordant voices. Not many, but you started to hear some. But they were crazy. They didn't know what they were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were just... There's always a few. So I don't think what he said... it doesn't stick out in my mind.
It didn't register at the time. It wasn't a topic of conversation amongst you and the other officers that you worked with or anything like that?
I don't think so. I mean, we talked about Vietnam, but our office, see, by this time I was the deputy post judge advocate. Been there 3 months and got promoted to deputy because I was a senior guy by a day or two. I don't know how it happened, but... the deputy left, and so there was a colonel and these four captains who didn't know what they were doing, and then the poor guy. And actually, I was the only bachelor, so I was more concerned about dating nurses than I was about other things. At least I spent a lot of time doing that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So when did you get word from your branch that you were definitely going to be going to Vietnam?
Well, I called them again in, I told you, I called them early in June or July, and I called them back in August, and I told them, you know, I still hadn't heard from you guys. Maybe I called them early June or something. And I called and I spoke to Barney Brannon, who was then up there, and I said, Barney, I want to go to Vietnam. He said, yeah, your name was mentioned as you were eligible. I said, well, no, I actually volunteered. So then we talked, and he said, okay, I told him January would be the right time to go, and he said, that's fine. And so from that point on, I knew I was going to Vietnam. And I think August of 67, I went back to Charlottesville for the Law in Vietnam course. I don't remember a lot of what they taught us there, but I think we did a lot of how to do things and some probably law war stuff and stuff like that. So by that time, I knew I was going, and I probably got my orders in September, I guess, maybe October.
Okay. But you don't recall what they taught you at the law at that course, the Law of War and stuff like that?
No, I almost think, you know, after being in Vietnam a year, that the way they should have taught that course is put you in a room with a telephone that wasn't connected to anything and told you to make a phone call. That's as bad as communications were in Vietnam. But I can't recall anything specific. One guy had been in Vietnam, came back and told us how they had tried a civilian by summary court-martial, and he was bragging on, you know, how they did it as a practical solution, and I thought that was a travesty. I really don't recall much about the class other than being there.
Mm-hmm.
I just can't recall what it was.
I take it what you mean by that being a travesty is there are stipulations that civilians are not tried by military courts constitutionally.
Well, under the code, there is an exception that civilians accompanying the forces in the field can be tried by a court-martial. That's one of the exceptions. I think there's another exception, but I can't recall it right off. But when you try somebody by summary court-martial, that proves nothing. I mean, that's just, you know, and he was setting this up as a great precedent, and I'm saying, it's just hogwash. So that's the only thing, I remember about that.
Okay. So you left, I guess, early January? You arrived in Vietnam in early January?
Yeah, I left Fort Sam before Christmas, and I visited my folks, and I went out in San Francisco for a few days. Then I got to Travis sometime around the middle of January, and I should have known right then things weren't going to go right. I remember I had a 4 o'clock port call, so that would have been a 6 o'clock flight. And I'm in there, and I'm calling my folks to tell them I'm about to leave, and they called my name, and our plane was delayed 12 hours, so all night at Travis. And we left sometime in the morning, flew to Hawaii, got to Hawaii about dawn, spent a couple hours walking around Honolulu Airport, got back on the airplane, flew across the Pacific to Guam, walked around that airport for a few hours, then got on the plane, flew to Clark Field in the Philippines, walked around there for a few hours, and then finally got to Vietnam, and it was in the evening. I have no idea what day it is. Sometime before the 20th of January of 1968, I arrived in Vietnam at Ben Hoa. And I remember they loaded us on the buses, and they took us to the 90th Replacement Detachment, I guess that's what it was called, and you had to drive through Ben Hoa, and I remember seeing what it looked like. It was you know, the ramshackle, corrugated tin type places that look overcrowded and, and not real, not, but it was evening. And so we got to the Repo Depot and spent the night there because I had had my son. And so the next morning they came and picked me up and took me up to 2 Field Force, which was, I don't remember the highway number, but you had the main Long Bend Post, which is a real big post, and then just off of that was the 90th Replacement Battalion, or detachment, I guess battalion. And then just past that, in another compound, was 2 Field Force, Plantation compound, and that's mm-hmm. where we went. So I had a 5-minute ride to my office, or
okay.
to my command, and so that's where I went. So I got there the next day.
What do you remember about first arriving in Vietnam when you, I mean, like, right away, first thing, right off the plane, what's it like?
Hot, humid, very uncomfortable climate. Mm-hmm. So disoriented by being on a plane so long, you don't really care much about anything, and, you know, you just don't know what's happening. Just being there real quiet and trying to find out where we're going.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, what's happening next.
Okay. What was the unit like when you arrived the next day?
Well, the staff judge advocate was temporary. The old one had left in before Christmas. The new one hadn't come in yet.
Mm-hmm.
The deputy was, as it turned out, was on my plane. With me, and so I met him on the plane.
Mm-hmm.
There were two other officers there, Tom O'Connell and Ned Felder, and it was five-person office. Five officers, and then we had a warrant officer, and we had some enlisted guys. And, I guess they gave me a room in the BLQ. We had these two-story wooden buildings that mm-hmm. we had, and they got me a room there, and don't really remember much else about getting in there, but, you know, just processed in, I know, don't recall that, and then started to work. I think what they did at the beginning is they made me an assistant trial counsel, and let me think. Yeah. Well, I'm not sure if I was assistant trial counsel or assistant defense counsel. I don't recall it right now, but I know that within about 3 or 4 days, I had to fly up to Tainan. No, I had to go beyond Tainan. I flew to Tainan and then got on another helicopter and flew up to a fire support base because I was interviewing some witnesses for a court-martial that was coming up the next week.
Mm-hmm.
No, I just can't remember if I was defending or prosecuting in that one. I don't remember. So there I am, and I'm pretty green in country. We fly in this fire support base, and the night before, they had just had a ground attack. And there were bodies still in the wire. But, welcome to Vietnam. But I did what I had to do, and I went back to Tainan. I talked to some other people, and I remember the funniest thing. They didn't even have jungle boots for me at the headquarters. I got them from a sergeant up at Tainan. He got me a pair of jungle boots. And then, of course, I flew back to Long Bend, and the next week we were in trial in this case, which is, I mean, forgettable case in that respect for me. I don't remember all that much about it.
Do you recall what the charges were?
No, not that case. I don't have any recollection. Of course, yeah, this is very late January 1968. And I remember, not sure if it's the night of the 30th or the night of the 31st, but our boss comes in to us. He used to, now by this time, we had gotten our new staff judge advocate. He had come in, so he was brand new over there also. He was a screamer. Not a nice guy, but a screamer. And he went to the 5 o'clock briefing. And then he came back and said to us, you guys better stick close to your helmets tonight. And for the first time, they had blacked out the compound. And 3 o'clock in the morning, on either the 30th or 31st, I'll call the day, I heard these strange noises. And I woke up in my bed and I said, holy shoot, we're getting hit. So I, the rockets came in. There were rockets, and I think they stopped. And I ran downstairs to the bunker, which was in the BOQ area. And a bunch of officers were there, and the rockets by that time had stopped, were standing around. And so I went back to my room, because I had slept that night in Bermuda shorts and shirt. So I went back, put on my uniform, got my helmet. Well, I had my helmet. Got my pistol belt, I guess. And we didn't have flak jackets. And went back to the bunker area. And then some small arms started coming in. And these guys started locking and loading. And I'm saying, I don't think I want to be standing around these officers when they're locking and loading. So I just walked in the bunker and I laid down and I fell asleep. I must have been tired because adrenaline was going, but I slept for a couple hours. And I got up about 6 and I guess I cleaned up and then went to eat. While I was standing in line in the mess hall, the largest explosion, the loudest explosion I ever heard in my life went off. They had blown, the sappers had gotten the night before, and they, I guess the charges went off and blew up the Long Bend ammo dump. And I remember we all ran outside, and I looked around, and I was still holding my plate. I didn't have any food on it. I mean, it was just holding the plate. So that was my introduction to Ted. Mm-hmm. For us, it was pretty dicey. There was an NVA regiment. There was some heroism that night, I'm sure, all over the country. But right across the highway, actually, we had about 3 strands of barbed wire. That was all we had on security. The security in that place was very poor. And this is a Corps headquarters. Across the highway was a widow's village. I guess widows of Arvin troops live there. Our MPs that night had just gone over there. You know, they decided, hey, we better check this out. And so they drove through the village, didn't see anything. And as they were exiting the village, they took some fire from the village. And so they knew something was up. Mm-hmm. And so there was a shooting going on back and forth. Meanwhile, as luck would have it, we were training Cobra pilots at Benoit. And there were instructor pilots over there. Mm-hmm. And General Lyon got them up in the air, and they killed over 100 NVA right along the highway, right across the highway from our compound. So we probably would have been overrun or had a good chance. We would have been in some serious trouble that night had not these MPs done their job by getting in there and alerting what was going on. And man, I was real impressed by that work. So that was the first night of Tet. And after that, we were in no danger. General Lyon brought up a lot of troops and we were covered. There was a lot of noise that night. I didn't sleep much the next night. Mm-hmm. But we were really safe. Mm-hmm.
Was there much action around the headquarters besides just what happened with what you just described as far as bases that were near?
I don't think so. I'm not sure it's the north. Probably not the north. Probably to the east of us was the 199th Infantry Brigade. Mm-hmm. And Lyon brought in some Cav to 11th Cav and they were out outside of our area there, so we were okay. I don't think there was anything real close to us. I don't recall. I don't think there was anything of any significance close to us.
Okay. What about trial work that you did that you do recall as far as...
Okay, yeah.
Important cases and cases that stick out in your mind?
There were about... there were several that were important. Mm-hmm. One was the... I'm trying to think it in order. Well, the first one was this... they all came in the latter half of the year, the important ones. We had this murder case. Zeller and Holly. There were two troops, and they're in a truck, and they're riding down the highway with a third guy who's driving. And the Holly is fooling around with his weapon. He says, "My weapon is jamming on me, M16. The driver says, "Hey, I'm having trouble with a tire. I'm going to pull over to that Vietnamese tire shop." So he pulls in there, and Holly says, "I'm going to go test fire my weapon." Zeller says, "Well, I'll go test fire my weapon." So Zeller and Holly go out behind this building, behind this tire shop, big open field. And one of them shoots in one direction, and the other says he shot 90 degrees in the other direction. And about at the 45-degree mark, Vietnamese winds up dead. So those are the basic facts of the murder case. So I'm defending Zeller. Another guy is defending Holly when we go to court. They're charged with murder. And we conceded, there was some evidence, that we conceded that the death occurred from an M16 round. Mm-hmm. But our theory was they couldn't prove who did it. The government couldn't prove who did it, and that these guys were not working as criminals in a criminal enterprise where both are liable for all the acts of the perpetrator. Mm-hmm. These are just two guys shooting, test firing their weapons. While the jury is out, the jury compromised. They were charged with murder, which carries a life sentence. The government theory is the government couldn't prove intent to kill, mm-hmm. but the government says they're doing a reckless act, evincing a wanton disregard for human life, which is murder 3 under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, Article 118, paragraph 3. And our theory is you can't prove who did it. Well, the jury compromises and finds them both guilty of negligent homicide. Obviously a compromise, and obviously they rejected the government theory, but they didn't want these guys to get away with something. Holly got 6 months and no kick from the general court. Zeller got 9 months because we also had a unrelated marijuana charge that they tried with it. Mm-hmm. Well, so we did our best, and that case went up to the Court of Military Review, which was the first appellate body, and they reversed the convictions on the same theory that we argued at trial, that we were doing, that these guys were doing a lawful act in a lawful manner, mm-hmm. and they were not acting in concert to do a criminal act, and therefore you had to prove which one did it. Mm-hmm. So they both were absolved of the homicide. Now there's a postscript to this, as there always is. Zeller winds up in Germany a couple of years later, and Zeller is convicted of fragging an officer there for attempted murder, and he got 19 or 20 years there. And the same judge, Jack Crusher, who was a judge at the Zeller trial in Vietnam, is a judge in Germany. Another interesting thing in that case that could only happen in Vietnam. We walk in to start the trial, and Crusher sees these two M16 rifles on the floor, and he says, "Whose rifles are those?" And I said, "Well, they're the accused rifles." He says, "You mean the murder weapons?" I said, "No. These guys had to come from Bearcat this morning. They had to be armed." But Bearcat was about 20 kilometers down the road from our headquarters. And, hey, if you got to travel. In fact, that's something you can only see in Vietnam. Another thing on that line with weapons. We had about five or six special forces soldiers, all enlisted, charged with using certain means to gather information from witnesses, from VC. What happened was they got the VC in a room and they used some electricity on him, and he talked and all that. And then they took the guy to a doctor, and the doctor turned him in. So they're all charged with various offenses. Mm-hmm. And but they only charge the enlisted guys. And they give immunity to the officers, which was dumb from a prosecution standpoint. Mm-hmm. Well, as it turned out, my guy wound up with an Article 15 oral reprimand, and he was getting out of the Army anyhow, so that was great. But, mm-hmm. but the funny thing, when we had the Article 32 investigation, we had five accused, six defense lawyers, I think one had two, we had a prosecutor, and we had the investigating officer. So we had about 12 or 14 of us in the room. Everybody's carrying a weapon. Loaded weapon. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'll try that here. But, you know, those are some of the things that happened in Vietnam. I had another case.
Let me ask a question about the Zeller and Holly case.
Yes.
They didn't have any form of ballistics as far as to verify the...
No, they didn't. But they had the description of the wound, mm-hmm. which was, as I recall, a characteristic of an M16, small entry, large exit wound. Mm-hmm. These guys were firing at the time, so I think there was a witness. There was a Vietnamese witness out there. So it was reason to believe that one of these two shot. Mm-hmm. And sometimes in trial work, it's better to concede stuff that isn't going to hurt you, mm-hmm. rather than, you know, and just go for what the main issues were in the case. Mm-hmm. I think it was a better tactic to argue, okay, one of them did it, but you can't tell which one. I mean, mm-hmm. essentially that. And that's what we did. Mm-hmm. That was our theory. Mm-hmm. And actually, it proved out, but out of the trial.
Right. And no word about what happened to Holly in the future?
No. Holly had a clean record when he left the Army, so well. I don't know.
Now, in with the Special Forces case, what happened? Did they, as far as the officers, were they eventually brought in and charged and tried as well, or did their immunity hold?
No, the officers were given immunity, and they testified at the 32, so they were free. I mean, they were absolved. I don't know if they made the Army a career. I doubt it, with that somewhere in the background, but mm-hmm. but. They couldn't be charged at that time, mm-hmm. and it was a bag of worms for the command anyhow. And it would have been a mess. And of course, if we had to defend that, the argument would have, because you had enlisted members on the court, mm-hmm. Yeah, they let the officers go, and they're hanging the E-5s and E-6s, and it would have been a mess for the government. And they knew it.
So none of the Special Forces guys was actually brought to trial, to conclusion?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
They all pleaded some lesser
punishment?
Well,
they all got Article 15s or reprimands or something. And like, my guy's getting out of the Army, gets a reprimand, big deal. That's not a conviction. That's a clean record. So that's the way to do it. Take it and run.
Did you hear of other instances of torture while serving as a staff judge advocate?
Well, I was at this time I was a trial lawyer.
The trial lawyer?
Yeah. Torture? No, but I had, I'll tell you another case I defended. Uh-huh. I'll let you decide. It wasn't torture. The unit is out in the field 3 days after Tet, 3 weeks after Tet.
Mm-hmm.
NVA, VC bodies all over the place. You know, I mean, a lot of kills. My client is accused of telling a enlisted guy to go out in the field, cut off the head of a dead body because he wants to clean up the head and put the skull on his track. So the enlisted guy cuts off the head of a dead body. Now, the body's been out there 3 weeks. It's decomposing. He brings the body back. It brings the head back. The head is then boiled in a pot of water. There are pictures of my client standing next to the pot of water. And he boils the head, and he cleans off the skull. So my guy is a Sergeant E7 with 20 years service, and he's charged with violating MACV directives by ordering the soldier to chop off the head and by boiling the head in a pot of water. And the government has... Well, from a defense standpoint, the evidence is awful.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, there was a soldier who was going home. So, the soldier is out in the field taking motion pictures. And in the beginning of the picture, he takes a picture of this body with the face up. At the end of this reel of film, you have this head in this pot of water with my client stirring. So obviously, you know, alibi is no defense. He was there, and we had to figure out how to defend that case. The charge was in two parts: boiling the head and ordering the soldier to chop it off and boiling the head. The government had all these pictures, and I had to get these pictures. I couldn't get the. I mean, I had to keep these pictures out of evidence because that would inflame the jury.
Mm-hmm.
So the theory was, what we did is we pleaded guilty to the boiling the head part, and not guilty to the part about the ordering the soldier to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, because of the way we pleaded, the pictures weren't necessary. So we kept the pictures out. He got convicted of the whole thing, and he got a... I don't know. I think he got a one-grade bust or a fine. I think a one-grade bust and a fine of not much money. And he was very pleased, and so was I, because facing the loss of a 20-year career. That was... one of those unique Vietnam type cases.
Mm-hmm. But the actual charge was violating the MACV directive.
What we did, I think, what I was told the Army did or the command did, is to avoid violations of the law of war. So basically what we did is we took all violations of the law of war and mm-hmm. made them MACV directives. And then you could charge him that way and avoid having war crimes. So we never committed a war crime. And Callie never committed a war crime. He ordered 100 or so people killed, which is murder, but not a war crime, because we could do it that way. A legal way of avoiding a blemish of having the United States commit war crimes. Mm-hmm. Now, from a political standpoint, I don't have any problem with that. I mean, the same act, but if it helps your country, it doesn't hurt anybody, it doesn't hurt the client, it's no big deal.
What did you, as a trial judge, a trial lawyer, and the other gentlemen working with you as trial lawyers, what did you think of that particular aspect of how the United States was conducting itself from a legal standpoint? Here we have, we have been very strong supporters of the law of war. And we've been, after World War II, we kind of pushed that in terms of trying Nazis and things like that. And then we're trying to skirt the issue here, Vietnam. Yeah, we'll just make it.
Well, like
was there
I
any
said,
discussion about that kind of stuff? Or
I didn't mind that. Yeah. That didn't bother me. Of course, we were down at the bottom, you know, and we didn't see much of a big picture, but that really didn't bother me.
Yeah.
My concern, because when I was a defense counsel, it was different, but my concern when I had cases to prosecute was that we put these criminals in jail and we prosecuted these criminals, and I wasn't worried how we did it. Yes, it's got to be legal and it's got to be right and all that and ethical in accordance with the laws of the legal profession. But whether you get Al Capone for tax evasion or murder, I don't care as long as you get it. And it's the same.
Okay.
It's the same thing. So that didn't bother me. Got involved in a more serious war crime murder case that wasn't as successful. I prosecuted this one. September 22nd, 1968, a unit of the 82nd is on patrol in somewhere north. I don't recall where.
Mm-hmm.
Their patrol is out with a company commander, Captain Kapranopoulos, is his name. Captain K, as his men call him. They see to their front a bunch of VC, who they believe to be VC, and I think they are. They send one patrol with a lieutenant in one direction, and they send another patrol with a sergeant, or some, E7 or so, in another direction. This happens contemporaneously, but the one with the lieutenant, they get out there. The VC is wounded, so shots have been fired. Loomis calls back on, tells the radio operator, Metalliano, I think his name, tell the captain we got a prisoner. Kapranopoulos gets on the phone and says, I don't want any prisoners. Loomis gets on the phone and says, Captain, I told you he's down, he's wounded. Kapranopoulos says, I don't want any prisoners. Third transmission, Kapranopoulos basically says, shoot him. I don't remember the exact words. Radio operator shoots the guy and kills him. Loomis had told Kapranopoulos he's down, he's wounded, he's down, he's wounded, and all that. And he said, meanwhile, over here on the other side, they capture another guy. He's surrendered. Kapranopoulos gets on the radio and says, you know what to do, and they shoot that guy and kill him. Now, normally, you'd have as a prosecutor, as I was a prosecutor, you have a tough time proving the radio transmissions and all that. Well, in this case, I had no tough time doing that. Because first of all, I had the lieutenant at the receiving end at one, and up on the hill, standing right next to the captain, is another lieutenant, a field artillery officer, the spotter, the field artillery observer, and he hears the captain on the radio. So, had an ironclad case of him ordering prisoners shot. I mean, just ironclad. This was an independent brigade of the 32nd, commanded by General Bowling. I had heard that he wanted to just whitewash the whole thing. His judge advocate named Van Buren, Neil Buren, I think that was his name. He said, you can't do that. You got to send it up to Corps. They sent it to us. We ran the 32. It was a clear case of murder. Go in, try the case. I think I've got an excellent case. I mean, I've got these two lieutenants. And jury acquits. Yeah, it's not surprising. We had what we called in, I'm sure you've heard the term, the mere group rule. And that's what the jury did. And in fact, about 6 months later, my staff judge advocate, or a year later, staff judge advocate told me he had seen one of the members of the court at Leavenworth. Mm-hmm. Not as a prisoner, but a student. The member of the court told the SJA that you know what we had to do, or we know we did it. But in fact, I even argued that this was before Cali, mm-hmm. before our conscience was totally clear. Even though it should have been. I got up and one of the things I argued on the merits one, I said, a lot of people argue that this is dirty war and that they fight dirty and. And we don't. And we should also. And I said, maybe it's one of the things that set us apart as an American soldier is that we don't do things like that. We don't kill prisoners. We knew what the issues were in the case. Legally, it was an easy case for me. But getting over that hurdle was just impossible. It was the fact, even the defense counsel said after the trial, he said, my strongest argument was one I couldn't make. And he was an ethical guy, and he put on his case, and a lot of lying from the unit, a lot of fudging from the commander. In fact, he called General Bowling as a witness. And Bowling's character witness. And they asked Bowling, why do you think this might have happened? Or, why were they edging? Bowling said, the unit just had a sapper attack, and they had lost some men, and, blah, 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 they were on edge. And I remember I got up to cross-examine Bowling, and my boss, the SJA, was sitting in the audience, and he pumps his fist at me a couple of times. I mean, go get him. Mm-hmm. But he knew I was there. I mean, I was not bragging, but I was pretty tough. I was mean. Mm-hmm. He got up, and, I got up, and I said, General, incident you talk about sapper attack, that happened the 29th of August, isn't there, something like that? He said, yeah. I said, that was more than 3 weeks before, wasn't it? He said, yes, it was. And I said, no further questions. Sat down. But it was just one of those cases that you couldn't win. Mm-hmm. What we were doing, we were going to try the captain first, and we were going to try the radio operator. Their excuse was, the radio operator said, the prisoner made a move at the medic who was attending him, and so he shot him to defend him, which was hogwash. But that was a mere group rule, and that's how that was one of the real facts of life that we had to overcome, and I couldn't. Mm-hmm. But like I said, we knew what the case we had, but we tried it. At least as a command. General Kerwin, who was then the commander, and my boss and myself, we said, no, you cannot let this go unpunished, but you cannot ignore it. You have to do what's right, and you let the chips fall where they may. Mm-hmm. That's what they did.
So why don't you go ahead and...
Okay, there are two other matters about this Kaepernickus case that came up. One was the unit had a motto called Wine, Women, and Body Count. And they got these buttons, like Avis had these round buttons, and they had that written on there, Wine, Women, and Body Count, and they kept that on their uniforms. The other thing I wanted to mention about this case is that shortly after that, the Army made a war crimes film, and this case was the basis of that film, How to Handle Prisoners. It was a good case to use in a sense that you didn't have to use names and you could use the scenario, and nobody had any no individual was going to be libeled or slandered in any way. Mm-hmm. But anyway, that's one of, those are the only two things about that case that I recall that.
Was there any sense amongst the people involved in the case or the command that, you know, one of the bad things about killing prisoners is that you've got the Chuhoy program, you've got these a lot of propaganda about, well, don't get captured because Americans will kill you, they'll torture you, kill you. Or is there any sense that, you know, this is kind of bringing that to fruition? We've got to be careful because it is counterproductive to kill prisoners.
Of course there was, and everybody knew that. I mean, you know that,
yeah.
But you when you teach some of this stuff, you pose the scenario where you capture somebody, where if you have the unit exposed on out in the field without support, and they have some enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly enemy, no issue about that. How do you handle them? If you keep them alive, you may expose yourself to peril.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the dilemmas. Now, you know, from an academic exercise, the answer is real simple.
Mm-hmm.
From a practical exercise, it's not.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why we have to teach the law of war, and that's why the Army, well, when I say the Army, because I'm familiar with the Army, but the services, mm-hmm. over the years have spent a lot of emphasis on how to properly accord yourself in accord with the law of war.
Mm-hmm. Now, the film that was produced as a result of this for war crimes, was that something shown to all incoming soldiers? I mean,
this was an Army training film.
Yeah.
So I'm sure it was widespread. Now, this is a 1970 vintage film, mm-hmm. 1970s vintage film. So I'm sure there have been several iterations of other types of films since. But just that this case was a classic of how not to handle, you know, not to do things.
Mm-hmm.
We never got into the issues of whether the unit was in peril or danger because the captain denied giving the radio transmissions. He denied ordering the prisoner shot, things like that. So you never got into a justification. It never happened. But that was real life back then.
Mm-hmm. What other cases?
Well, actually, you know, if I think back, each case seemed to have a life of its own and interest. I mean, all weird things. Like, I had this kid I'm defending. He goes into the Tom Sanute finance office with an unloaded pistol, and he says, "Stick 'em up." And he runs out with $6,000, he gets on his moped, goes a little bit, has an accident, and gets caught. Okay, this kid, you know, you think, well, what kind of a bum is he? And you find out this kid had not only served a year in Vietnam, but extended twice. And when he came back from either the second... all right. In those days, if you extended for 6 months, they gave you a 30-day leave, I think, in the States, or wherever you wanted to go. So he came back from the second 30-day leave. So he'd been there already 18 months. And he winds up with his girlfriend. He doesn't go back to his unit. And his girlfriend says, "My mother needs the money," and you know, one thing leads to another. And so he does this. So you got a good soldier here. I mean, really a good soldier who, as luck would have it, hasn't harmed anybody. And, you know, the monies were covered. And so, I was lucky. When I defended, most of the guys I defended were good guys. They did stupid things, but they were good guys. And when I prosecuted, I was prosecuting evil people who did evil things. Mm-hmm. Now, that made, and I think that's more than just my perspective at the time. Mm-hmm. But anyhow, this guy's name was Sharp, and we go to a general court martial and plead guilty. I mean, what did he doubt about? We pleaded guilty to the AWOL, to the AWOL there, and the desertion. I mean, the robbery. And the jury gave him like 15 months and no discharge. And we were thrilled. I mean, the time was nothing. I think they commuted that, but he got no discharge. And that was the thing we really fighted. Mm-hmm. Sergeant Oldham. Sergeant Oldham, another super troop with a strange record. The VC mines a road up somewhere. Oldham's in the 11th Cab. Mm-hmm. They mine a road, they blow it up, and then two Vietnamese trucks go into the hole. I mean, like, you couldn't see the big hole in the middle of the day. So Oldham gets up there with his troop. He's a lead scout. What they're trying to do is clear the road, get the trucks out, and get the hole filled in. Well, the Vietnamese are, as happens so often, they're climbing all over the place, and you couldn't separate them. You couldn't get anybody back. So Oldham picks up a hand grenade, and he pulls the pin, and he holds it up to get people to get back. And he's not going to hurt anybody. So he does that. The Vietnamese get back. So then Oldham goes to throw the grenade out into the rice paddy. Well, just as he does that, some Vietnamese, of course, doesn't get back. He comes by on a bicycle or something, or on a moped. Oldham throws it. The grenade hits the moped, glances into the crowd, kills three and injures a bunch of people. So now we're charging. Now Oldham is charged with involuntary manslaughter, which carries a punishment of 3 years for each killing, plus some aggravated assaults. So we're in court trying to figure that one out. I mean, these are unique to Vietnam. I mean, where mm-hmm. else could you have these yeah. kinds of weapons cases except in a war zone? Mm-hmm. And Oldham, everybody loves Oldham. Oldham is the greatest, one of those great soldiers, a lead scout in a cav platoon. In fact, the trial counsel, there's an old saying in the law, I'm sure you've heard it, never ask a question you don't know the answer to. Mm-hmm. Well, anyhow, he says to the commander, the captain, he says, well, you think Oldham has the maturity and the ability to be a lead scout? And the captain says, well, the other night we had to go 10 clicks and we wouldn't have made it without him. And this is in front of a military jury, and Oldham, the jury goes out. I swear they weren't out about 2 minutes, came back with a 2-grade bust, and that was it, the general court. And that was pretty good since he was facing 11 years. Mm-hmm. We had offered to plead guilty in return for, I forgot what kind of a deal. We asked a pretty sweetheart deal. And my boss said, run that through Patton. Now, Patton at that time was commander of the 11th Cab. Mm-hmm. So we ran the deal through Patton, and Patton says, in the typical Patton mythology, kill a son of a bitch. I don't want to do anything for this guy. And so, after the trial, I was kind of happy with tell Patton what he could do with it. the biggest, toughest job I had there was involving the Long Beach Stockade riots. The way it starts for me, it's the very end of August 1968, and I'm flying from 2 Field Force to Saigon, And you go flat right down the highway. And like I said, I don't think it's Highway 1, but whatever highway that was. Mm-hmm. And you fly right on the outskirts of Long Bend Post. And I look over there, and the stockade looks... And I said to myself, gee, it looks like the stockade had a fire. That didn't mean anything to me. I got to Saigon, and my friend and I went to Tokyo. We had a week, not R&R, leave in Tokyo. Mm-hmm. So I'm over there, and then I'm, the next day or 2 days later, I'm in the Sano Hotel in Tokyo, and I pick up the Stars and Stripes, and it says a story about the riot. And I said, uh-oh, I've been stockaded at a riot. I'm going to be busy when I get back. Mm-hmm. Well, when I got back, we got the new SJA. Now, this was my third SJA in the time that I was there. And he says, you're prosecuting from now on. You're not defending. I said, I like to defend. He says, no, you're too mean to prosecute, to defend. You're prosecuting. So I got this tiger by the tail. Now, there were, the way they did it, the command took a big task force of CID agents, mm-hmm. and they went into stockade and interviewed everybody they could find, got statements and that. But they only could they correlated the statements only by name. Like if one witness had given the names of 10 people, you could find those statements under any of those 10 people. But if they had said, I saw this guy hit some other guy in front of tent 4, you couldn't find that statement. I mean, you had no way of retrieving that statement. Well, what they did is they gave all these, they took all the charges, or they took the statements, they sent it up to USRB headquarters, a JAG office there, they prepared the charge sheets, then they sent it to each command, and we prosecuted the people from our command who were in the stockade. And I wound up with 4 of them, including Private Kopich, who was really the leader of the riot. The riot was, all right, the stockade was overcrowded. Mm-hmm. It was terribly overcrowded. The riot was really a race riot. It was black on white. I mean, that's what the riot was. What the causes are, there are a lot of causes, including the heat, the overcrowding, the conditions which weren't good for people to live in. But Kopich, that night the riot starts. Kopich is in this one compound, and he leads a bunch of the rioters, all blacks, toward the fence. There's a guard there. Somehow he cold cocks the guard. They get out into the main compound. Kopich then goes into the mess hall and gets something to eat. And then he goes down, he leads a bunch of blacks down to the box. The box was the segregation area. Administrative segregation and disciplinary segregation. And there are two white MP guards down in the box. And Kopich is going around and he's spreading some liquid in each of the cells. What they do is they let the blacks out of the cells. These are individual cells. But white prisoners are kept in the cells. And he's spreading this liquid. It's some kind of a, we think it was a flammable liquid. He's trying to kill people. And he tries to light this liquid, and he can't light it. Meanwhile, I mentioned these two white guards. And I mention that for a reason, because this is a race riot. These guards get on top of the box. And there's a whole bunch of angry blacks ready to kill these people. And then one of the most amazing things that I've ever heard of happened. A guy named Planter, who's a prisoner. Planter is the informal leader of all the blacks in the stockade. And there's no evidence that he's rioting mm-hmm. that night. Now, he may have been in the box at that time or not. I don't recall that. But Planter says to these two guards, if you come down, I'll get you out of here safely. And these guards come down, and they follow Planter, and Planter takes them, you know, what, 100 yards across these rioting compound of prisoners, and they get out unscathed. I mean, just, you only see that in the movie, but that's the truth.
Wow.
And upshot was, Planter was never prosecuted for anything that happened that night. Planter was prosecuted for some drug offense, I think, and eventually the Court of Military Appeals reversed his conviction, I mean, on a legal issue, whatever the legal issue was related to his case.
Mm-hmm.
But, that was just an amazing thing that happened that night. Now, mm-hmm. Kopich, well, we tried four out of this trial. Kopich pleaded not guilty. He was found guilty and given 15 years. It was a relatively easy case to try because he was so, and the evidence was so overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
One guy I tried and pleaded not guilty. I could, had a very weak case. My only witness against him was a white prisoner who was convicted of manslaughter and who should have been convicted of murder. And the judge let all the evidence in to show that the guy really should have been convicted of murder. So I was stuck arguing to the members that they should believe this murderer. Not the easiest prosecution, but we knew it going in. But, you know, you take the evidence the way you find it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some of the evidence we had to put together, like I told you, that these statements weren't correlated, mm-hmm. except by name.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as it turned out, Zeller, talk about intertwined mm-hmm. things, Zeller is serving his sentence at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I talked to Zeller, and Zeller tells me about what happened and I use Zeller as a witness. I also find out, I have two cases, and I forgot the names of the accused, but they happened in adjoining tents, the crimes, whatever the crimes were. And so I'm saying to myself, okay, the CID doesn't, you know, only correlates by names, but I have these two, and since they're adjoining tents, maybe somebody, some of my witnesses from tent A saw something at tent B. So I started interviewing the witnesses that way, and I dug up some evidence on two more people that we were able to use and prosecute.
Mm-hmm.
It was so tough. It was first of all, you had this mountain of evidence, and you had this at the stockade, and it's in Vietnam. You can't use phones because the phones really don't work. I'm at the stockade every day interviewing people and trying to find out what happened. Oh, the CID did a good job. They were overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm.
And I could concentrate on just a few things. I remember calling my boss saying, hey, Barney, I just found out there's a witness in Tain Inn. He says, hey, I know the commander out there. I'll call him. You'll get the witness. And that's how it worked. It's just incredible the amount of extra work you had to do for simple stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I remember, you know, I mean, I think I felt more professionally pleased at my work for the Stockade Riot cases than I think I've ever done anything because of how hard it was to put it together because of the logistics, not because of the outcome or anything. I mean, the trial was the easy part. I always found that, you know, if you did all your preparation, the trial wasn't as difficult, and it really wasn't. You know. But that was a tough thing to put together. And one other case, anything about the riot? Or?
Well, I was curious if the riot and the convictions resulted in terms of any changes at the stockade in terms of the overcrowding and the conditions and stuff like that?
A sea change. First of all, they had a lot of damaged areas, so you couldn't put as many prisoners there.
Mm-hmm.
They cleared out. They realized they had screwed up. They sent a lot of prisoners all over the Far East, Okinawa, other places. They they started really curtailing the number of pretrial confinements. They watched that very closely. They brought in a commander to the stockade named Ivan Nilsen. Naturally, Ivan the Terrible, but in his case it was well-earned. Ivan straightened that place out. He made it as tough as nails to be in there. Prisoners, if they saw an officer, a prisoner had to come to attention, take his cap off and slap his thigh and say, "Prisoner Jones, sir." The salute is considered a privilege, and prisoners were not given the privilege of saluting. Oh. So that's how they had to do it. Every prisoner who went in the stockade spent 14 days in a connex, in administrative segregation, to get the message across to him or to get his attention. I didn't agree with all his methods. I believe in a war zone, especially in a war zone, a stockade should be very, very tough. Mm-hmm. Not cruel and not torture, but very, very tough, because the idea is that you want the soldier to know what, the soldier to have a mindset that he'd rather take his chances with the enemy in the field than he would with Ivan Nilsen mm-hmm. in the stockade. And I don't have any problem with that, because stockade serves a different purpose there. Mm-hmm. But I think he probably went over the line in some respects. I never had to defend it. I never had to justify it because I didn't have any cases that involved that, and that was a different command. That was Yusevi mm-hmm. who had to answer to that. I just had to do my own thing. Okay. But the stockade changed immensely, and the command, the senior commanders understood they could take care of it. They could control the stockade, not let every commander who wanted put prisoners in pretrial confinement for any reason or no reason at all. Well, not no reason at all, but for any ridiculous reason. In fact, I defended a guy at the same time where that issue came up. Ulysses Sori was his name. And Sori was in the 199th Infantry Brigade, and Sori is on guard duty outside of Saigon, in the suburb of Saigon. And Sori gets off his tour duty, and he goes, instead of his unit, goes to the whorehouse. And looking for his favorite whore, hey, we ran the 32 in the whorehouse. So this is, again, Vietnam. What was natural there is not natural in the big thing. Yeah. Sori, looking for his favorite whore, gets involved with another whore, and somehow she winds up getting shot with his M16. I don't think she was killed. No, she was not killed, but she's shot with the M16. And Sori is in by this whorehouse, which is in an off-limits area. Well, he's charged with, aggravated assault and being in an off-limits area. Sori is in the stockade in pretrial confinement at the time of the riot. And he does nothing. He does absolutely nothing. He doesn't commit any offense that night at all. Mm-hmm. So I asked the command to take him out of pretrial confinement, or at least review the reason why he's in pretrial confinement. And they gave me the hell no, he's staying, drop dead, captain, who the hell are you, and all that. I said, fine. One of the ways I operated was, I don't screw with you, you don't screw with me. You screw with me, I screw with you. That's just the way it works. Mm-hmm. So, at the trial, the only person who can prove he's in an off-limits area, that Sawyer received the order, that was not to be there, mm-hmm. was the battalion commander. That morning, the morning of trials, trials would start at 1 o'clock at night, in the afternoon. That morning, the adjutant from the battalion calls up and says, battalion commander isn't coming. So the trial counsel is on the phone and says, okay, it's the way you want to be, but I'm going to tell our chief of staff, who's a one-star general, that your battalion commander's not cooperating. So the battalion commander shows up. Now, we had already decided we were going to plead guilty to the being in the off-limits area, but not guilty to the ag assault and defense with some accident theory. Mm-hmm. But I didn't tell that to the government, because they screwed with my client by not even looking at the pretrial confinement. Mm-hmm. So we go to the courtroom. The courtroom's a Quonset hut, and the anteroom is the waiting room, and then you have the main courtroom. The main courtroom has an air conditioner in it. The waiting room doesn't. You have to walk through the waiting room, get to the main courtroom. Here's the battalion commander. And, you know, first of all, he's scared because he can tell the general on him. He's sweating. I mean, you can't sweat more than this guy can. I walk right by him. We walk in there and plead guilty. And the trial counsel drops his teeth. Oh, I didn't know that. You know, blah, blah, blah. And, of course, the battalion commander didn't have to come. Mm-hmm. And all that threats that day. And I said, hey, guys. You know, you screw with me, that's the way it goes. You know, if you guys had shown a decency, just a little decency, mm-hmm. you wouldn't have to do this. But the hell with you. Now, it turns out, Sorry's convicted.
Yeah.
Not that that was a big surprise. But his first sergeant takes the stand. This is about 10 o'clock at night. His first sergeant spent about 2 hours at the NCO club. He wasn't just eating. And I remember he came in, big guy, well, infantry company, first sergeant, Leroy Winbush. I just remember the name. He says, First Sergeant Leroy Winbush reports. Because in those days, he actually reported to the president. And he says, yeah, Sawyer's a good soldier. You get him back to me, I'll take care of him. He got like a nothing sentence. I mean, he got some time. He got some confinement, but my boss said, no, he served enough. He was in pretrial. Mm-hmm. time served. He's out. He's back in the unit. So wow. That was my Ulysses story. But I always talk about that one because of the way the damn battalion commander just would not even give me the time of day. And I said, the hell with you. Mm-hmm. If you won't play it that way, then I'll play it that way. Mm-hmm. And that's how I've always been. You know, you shoot straight with me, I shoot straight with you, I shoot straight. But you play games with me, then boom, you reap what you sow. Mm-hmm. That's how I look at it. I'm trying to think if any other cases of any interest. I think it's more interest for me because I did them. But It's about, oh no, I had one other one that was another one. Where I was defense counsel and I was going after somebody. Mm-hmm. This captain was a nutcase. I mean, a real nutcase. And he was really riding my client. Riding him one day unmercifully. And I don't know, one day he got in a confrontation with my client, and he's chewing him out or something out in the field. And this sergeant walks over, or maybe not a sergeant, but a same E4, E5. While the captain is chewing out my client, this guy says something or laughs. So my client punches him or does something. So the captain jumps on top of my client, rips him down, ties him up with rope or something. It kind of... So the defense is going to be tough. Now my defense is, or our defense is, the captain angered my client, so my client punched the third guy. I mean, that's pretty tough to sell anybody. But the captain's a nutcase. And I find out about him, and I start getting all this information about him. So I asked the command to run a psychiatric evaluation of the captain, which hit the roof. I mean, well, the general hit the roof. So I gave my boss a whole bunch of stuff that I had on the captain. I said, yeah, you can tell the general this. This is why I asked it. I wasn't just playing games. I mean, I had some stupid things that this guy did. This guy flew off the handle. You know, he flies off the handle all the time and all this. And then there was an issue there of illegal command influence. Apparently the battalion commander had called all his officers together and said, when I have a court-martial, I want my courts to be tough. I don't want anybody getting tapped on the wrist, which is, of course, illegal.
Mm-hmm.
So I found out about that, and I asked for a change of venue, change out of the command, and I get it. Moves from the 199th Infantry Brigade to 2 Field Force Artillery. And we go to trial there, and the captain is testifying. And I said to the captain, in the course of, you know, you fly off the handle a lot, don't you? And he's proud of it. I said, remember the time that you went through that village and you shot up the whorehouse with an M50? He said, it was a 60 caliber. And my guy got like a nothing sentence. I mean, a nothing sentence. One great bust, maybe at the most. And I talked to one of the members afterwards. He said, as soon as he answered like that, we knew what we had. We had this nutcase that never should have been. I don't know how this is going to look, but basically what I did, like I said before, when I was defending, most of my guys, other than Zeller, I guess, were really good people who did stupid things.
Mm-hmm.
And the sentences reflected that. And I got lucky when I switched to prosecution. I got some evil people. Mm-hmm. The Stockade Riot, the murder case, which didn't turn out that way. I had some others, I'm sure, but I can't remember. But anyhow, I had those, and so it was easy to prosecute those, and you could get much more substantial outcomes because you're dealing with bad people doing bad things.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not bragging about how good I was. It's just that I was lucky, too.
Yeah. Yeah. And like you said, I think the decisions that the, as far as the punishments, that kind of validates what you said.
That was about all the trials I had. Trials are so hard to put together because of the logistics that you couldn't try that many.
Mm-hmm.
Had a flight evaluation board, another one of these weird cases, only in Vietnam. I represented a pilot. And this pilot, well, at an earlier time, he had killed somebody by running a skid into him. But I wasn't involved in that at all. But what happened is, when I got involved with him, he was accused of, they had something called a command pilot and a pilot on a helicopter. And this is vague, but my guy was senior to the other guy, but whether he was the command pilot or the pilot, I don't know, and he had been suspended. And so the command, this was the 11th Army Cav, they had the worst, I mean, they may be a great combat unit, they were, but when it came to administration, they were terrible, which was great for a defense leader.
Mm-hmm.
So my guy was charged with taking over the helicopter while the other guy was the command pilot or something, and they were going to pull his ticket. They wanted his license to fly an airplane. And we got in there and just really made a farce of it. The command was so sloppy with the paperwork that by the time we got through going through everything, nobody knew who was what and everything. And they said he'd go back flying again. Again, lucky that they had, you know, you don't do anything as a lawyer, just fall into this. Hey, this is a mess. You guys are nuts.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that was about all.
No other aviation trials? aviation questions?
No, that was the only aviation thing. I'm trying to think. Trying to go back and that's about all we had. Like, we didn't have that many cases, but the cases were interesting.
Yeah.
And you can spend some time enjoying them or putting them together. And the good thing was, back then, every trial was a jury trial.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to get up and you'd stand in front of members. You had to look colonel. I was captain, less than 2 years in the Army. You had to stand, stare these guys in the eye, and look at those eagles on their collar and talk to them. And, oh, wait a minute. And get results. There was one other case, I recall. Another one of these only in Vietnam cases. This aviation unit. It is an aviation unit, I guess. Okay, this aviation unit is stationed at Benoit, and this is after Tet. They have a USO troop come by or some party. Now, okay, the unit is stationed at Benoit. The enlisted men live on Benoit. The officers live downtown in another compound. The after Tet, for some reason, they had them lock up all their weapons. They didn't have individual weapons, but they kept them all in a locked container. Well, they had the USO show, or they have some kind of a traveling show. The officers and enlisted men are there. The officers leave, and they go back to their compound. The enlisted men stay behind, they start drinking too much. A sergeant, who has the key to the locker, opens the locker. The guys go downtown, shoot up the Benoit police station, and kill a Benoit policeman. So, in the time-honored tradition that sometimes prevails in the Army when common sense doesn't, somebody's got to blame.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody is to blame for this. So they offer the company commander, a major, and the platoon leader, a captain, Article 15s for this. That's right. Now, remember, they're living downtown in a different compound. There was a rumor going around that because of the outcome, they never had to pursue it, but that General Palmer, who was then the USERVE deputy commander, but the guy who worked at Long Beach, the guy who ran the day-to-day operations of the headquarters, he said, somebody's got to pay for this. And they took it, so they offered these guys Article 15s, and they were in the 1st Aviation Brigade. I think it was the 1st. I'm trying to think of the 1st or 12th, but I think it was the 1st. And we're saying, hey, so your officers turned it down. He said, you know, it's going to end their career. We're not going to do this. And the case was just ridiculous. So they referred it to regular special court martials. Now, you don't try officers by special court. Legally, you can, but you don't. The last thing you want in the Army is an officer with a court martial conviction on active duty. You know, I mean, it's just stupid. Well, we went to the general and said, you know, this is ridiculous, it's old case, it's speedy trial. they dismissed the charges and substituted the written reprimands not to be filed anywhere. But it was just the stupidity of even trying a case like that, or even thinking about blaming these officers for what happened. It's just absurd.
Mm-hmm. Were there any other instances like that that you recall where there had to be someone to pay, and so they brought charges against a commander or a platoon leader or a platoon sergeant?
Going back over Vietnam, I can't think of anything. But there's one thing I wanted to mention about Vietnam, and that was one of the, a complimentary thing. General Wyand was our CG at the for the first half of my tour there.
Mm-hmm.
And General Wyand, it was after Tet. I guess, like I said, I don't recall. I think we got hit on Tuesday night or Wednesday night, whatever it was. But on that Sunday, the following Sunday, General Lyon brought all the officers in the headquarters to the amphitheater that we had there. And he got up on the stage. I remember he stood up there and he took his helmet and he had it on his side and he stood at ease. And for a half hour, he just explained to us everything that happened and where it happened and why it happened and what we did about it. He just told us all about it. He basically said, we knew they were coming, we didn't know where, and we just prepared ourselves as best we could, and then we fought it. And I was just proud or honored by Lyon that he'd come down and take the time, because this is still only 5 days after Tet, and he's a corps commander, and he's got divisions engaged. Mm-hmm. And he came down to take the time to tell us just what happened. I thought that was just an example of leadership. Mm-hmm. and the way a general is supposed to be. Unlike, well, he in fact covered himself with glory in Vietnam because he was a soldier, and I think he knew what was happening. Mm-hmm. But he didn't command until it was too late to do anything about it for him. But I guess that was my professional time in Vietnam. I guess that covers it.
How were you treated upon your return? Because by the time you came back in late 68, Vietnam War's got a different flavor in the United States.
Well, that's true, but I'm in the Army. Yeah. So I visit my folks. I spend a couple of weeks with them. I visit old friends of mine, college classmates and stuff. Spent about 2 weeks with them, and then I went to Fort Bliss, and I was, back doing Army stuff. El Paso was not a hotbed of anti-war activity, so I never saw anything. I don't think I ever saw any anti-war stuff in the 6 months. I only spent 6 months at Bliss. I was the chief of military justice at the in the staff judge advocate office. I had both prosecutors and defense counsel working for me. Well, I supervised them and even tried a case. But really, I can't think of any anti-war stuff that was touching me directly. But even close. El Paso was at least where I lived, and El Paso depended a lot on Fort Bliss, the economy there, and it was pretty military town. Mm-hmm. So I didn't see anything of any consequence. I never saw any as Vietnam backlash or anything like that.
Okay. When you got back into the United States and continued to work as a staff judge advocate and as a trial attorney here as well, did you try any cases in the United States while the war continued that were related to the Vietnam War? That
yes.
Were
yeah, come think of it. In July of 69, I left Fort Bliss. I got there in January, and I left in July and became a military judge. Mm-hmm. Got to Fort Gordon, Georgia. And one of the cases we had a couple of these privates or trainees, 19, 20-year-old kids. They go down to a radio station in Augusta and get on the air and make some anti-war statements. I don't remember what, but nothing that by that time half the politicians in the United States hadn't uttered. And they also distributed some literature on the installation. Mm-hmm. There were four of them. I'm sorry, I said two, but there were four of them. So they were charged, all four of them were charged with making disloyal statements and distributing the literature on the installation without permission, which is a violation of a reg. It was some anti-war tract or so. Well, the first case, we had three judges at Fort Gordon, and we brought in a fourth to do the fourth case. So I tried, the first guy, the judge dismissed the charges. He actually made a mistake on legal grounds. It was a bad ruling from a legal point of view, but he ruled and that was it. So then I got the second case. We had a lot of publicity on this case. They had an ACLU lawyer from Atlanta. And this kid, the kid I was trying was from New York, somewhere in Long Island. And his, I guess his folks or somebody had alerted the newspaper there and then newspaper up there called Newsday, then it was Long Island Newsday. They kept running a lot of stories on it, a lot of AP stories. We had a group of people there and reporters for the trial. And these kids, not the statute, but the crime of disloyal statements is making statements disloyal to the United States. Mm-hmm. It's not making statements that the Army doesn't like. And this was a bench trial. In other words, I decided the findings and sentence, if there would be a sentence. Clearly, the guys distributed the literature, and military law is clear. It's content neutral that every installation has regulations. If you want to distribute literature on post, you've got to have permission. And that's reasonable. So I found him guilty of that offense. On the anti-war statements, like I said, I don't remember this day what the statements were, but they were just anti-war statements. We don't belong in Vietnam, get out of Vietnam, this or that. Did that tenor. Certainly not disloyal to the United States, but the Army did like it. The soldiers would do that. So I found them not guilty of that and gave them a restriction or something. I didn't give them much of a punishment. But that was the anti-war case, I remember. And then, when I went to Germany, that was a hotbed of problems. In Germany, the Army was faced with, I was in Germany 71 to 75 as a judge. Race, drugs, and some anti-war stuff, by that time, even the war was over, anti-military. Terrible combinations. We had, remember I tried a case. Guy's name was, there were a couple of things. One was Larry Johnson was his name. I think it was Larry Johnson. But anyhow, he was black. He decided that Portugal was oppressing blacks in Mozambique. The United States and Portugal were both members of NATO. Therefore, the United States was complicit in this oppression, and that he would no longer serve in the Army. So he quit the Army, and he quit wearing his uniform. And so we had these people over there, the Lawyers Military Defense Committee. They were sort of a left-wing, I'm not going to call them subversive, I don't mean that, but they were out, they were anti-military, anti-war. Mm-hmm. So I remember we had that kind of a case. And we had haircut cases where troops decided they didn't like the Army anymore, they were quitting the Army, they started haircut. They refused to get haircuts. We even had an officer do that. We had a whole bunch of these type of cases. Now, the Larry Johnson case turned out to be very significant in a strange sort of way. The defense came in and made a motion for the prosecution to disclose all the wiretapping Well, the prosecutor gets up and says, wiretapping? this guy's in Levi's. He's not uniform, but wiretapping. Now, under the statute at the time, the defense, in order to get more of a response from the government, the defense had to make a threshold showing that there was wiretapping. Well, they didn't have any evidence. And that, so all the government had to do was affirm or deny the existence of it. They said, there is no wiretapping. Okay, that ended that. Well, the next week, in the Overseas Weekly, they published transcripts of a wiretap involving the case. What happened was that this disaffected MI enlisted man gave these transcripts to the OW and they published it. Well, then it hit the fan. Mm-hmm. Then it became a big thing. And then the judges, now for every case that these lawyers represented, you know, these lawyers, military defense committee represented clients in these haircut cases. Now they say wiretap, and they throw in the transcript, and we'd say to the government, okay, now you got to get affidavits from the military intelligence people. Mm-hmm. And they started to give these mealy-mouthed affidavits, and we said, that ain't good enough. Not that this general doesn't know it. He has to say whether it exists or not. Mm-hmm. And that led eventually to the discovery of all the wiretapping in Berlin, and the Berlin Democratic Committee was being wiretapped, and that's how this all hit the fan. Through this innocuous case of this poor trooper who wouldn't wear his uniform, and that's... So, I mean, it was... Germany was just a hotbed of this, mm-hmm. this stuff. Then I had another case I tried, the Che Guevara poster case. A soldier wanted to hang a picture of Che Guevara in his bulletin. Well, the command charged him with violation of an order to take it down or something like that. And, I was really... Actually, that case gave me problems because I was... I didn't see a great problem with the poster case. Well, I'm not saying that. I didn't like it in an army billets. Mm-hmm. But I didn't want to make some issue out of free speech. And I had the lawyers, military defense committee, represent this guy, and they were yelling, free speech, free speech, free speech. And I don't want to get the First Amendment. I want to get rid of this case and some other grounds. You never want to make a First Amendment issue out of nothing. So I said, okay, you know, they're claiming the legal order, First Amendment, and all that. And I said, okay, why don't we hear this case as a motion to dismiss based on the legal order? And then, if you lose, then we'll have the merits, you know, and then I'll hear the merits. And they said, no. How'd it go? I'm trying to think now. I wanted to do it as a motion to dismiss, and they said no. Or the other way around. I'm not sure which. No, I said, whatever it was, anyhow. We litigated the case, mm-hmm. and we were litigating it on the merits. That's what it was. And the captain takes the stand, the company commander ordered it down, and he says, well, you know, I had no problem with this poster, but I had a problem with if this poster went up, then somebody would put up another poster, and then some Ku Klux Klan guy would put up a picture of the Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan, and a black would get upset, and I'd have a race riot. So no, I said, can't have the poster up. Well, there's a USERRA reg which said that you could that the poster itself had to be a clear danger to the morale or discipline of the unit. Mm-hmm. The poster, not the third poster, down the line. Mm-hmm. So I'm sitting there and I'm saying to myself, thank you, there is a God. Now I've got my out. I can dismiss this thing without making a finding of the, mm-hmm. on the Constitution, mm-hmm. and I can get out of this thing without causing a big roar. And one of the things lawyers do, and you taught this in your first day as a lawyer, you make the narrowest ruling you can make, which covers the issues in the case. Mm-hmm. So you don't start by saying the Constitution prohibits this if some regulation prohibits it.
Right.
So I remember what I did. I recessed the court. I went back. I wrote out my ruling. I mean, I actually wrote it out. I went back in the court. I read my ruling. I say, this is not a First Amendment issue. This is a regulation issue. The charge is dismissed. And I remember the lawyer from the lawyer's defense. I wanted to do it on the merits. He insisted on the motion. That's what it was. So then he gets up and says, but Your Honor, this doesn't leave us anywhere. We don't have an acquittal now. And I said, Mr. whatever name it was, you had your chance and you didn't want it. Therefore, you've got your ruling. Goodbye. Case adjourned. but that was, I guess, the last of the anti-war stuff. By that time, probably the war was over. The issues, I guess, were simmering down in Europe because we're getting a lot of drug cases. God, we're trying so many drug cases that we didn't have time for these other cases. Drugs were just rampant. We're trying heroin cases every day. I mean, heroin cases were just ridiculous. The Army was really in bad shape over there. Heroin use, heroin transfer, heroin distribution, sale, it was a lot of it. It was just rife.
Were there a lot of the cases that you tried against heroin users? This is harkening back to a stereotype. The stereotype of the Vietnam veteran as drug user. Were many of the heroin cases that you tried at users Vietnam veterans that you recall?
Not anything out of the ordinary. Actually, not really, because by that time the Army had wised up on some of its personnel policies. What we did is we had a... During the war, if you'd served your, a two-year draftee, mm-hmm. if he had served his time in Vietnam, he wasn't automatically discharged when he got out. If he had 6 or 9 months or maybe even less to do, mm-hmm. they signed him to a unit somewhere, mm-hmm. which was a mistake. But because of personnel shortages, I guess we had to do that. Mm-hmm. Eventually, we wised up and realized that these guys would just cause some trouble. I mean, they wanted out of the Army. They served a year in Vietnam. They served a year in hell. They only have 4, 5, 6 months to go. Why are we screwing around with them? Mm-hmm. So the Army started to get more enlightened and started to discharge these guys when they got back from Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So I'm talking about mid... 72, 73, 74, 75. By that time, most of these guys were either... Well, probably some of them were Vietnam people, but they were thinking about staying in the Army longer as mm-hmm. opposed to just the yeah. initial tour. Yeah. So I never recall that being a factor or mm-hmm. that being something that caught my mind.
All right, this is CD 2 of the interview with Judge Herb Green. All right, sir, would you go ahead and continue by discussing
your post-war perceptions of the Vietnam War. In particular, how was the Vietnam War important to you in your military career, and to also to how was it important to you personally? Is your, you know, your Vietnam War experience?
One of the reasons, well, it's, I went to Vietnam for several reasons. One, I had no intention of making the Army a career. It was going to be the great adventure of my life. And I went to serve my country. You know, George Bush says the duty honor country thing. Well, I believe in that. And so that's how I went. Afterwards, well, I can't describe the contempt I have for Robert McNamara, for the line, for the killing of American soldiers that I hold him totally responsible for the American government people who, personnel, leaders who lied to us. I have nothing but contempt for those people. I am totally disillusioned by the generals who ran that war, not knowing, not having the foggiest idea what they were doing. Westmoreland, Harkins, not Wyand. Wyand I have total respect for. Abrams, I think. Abrams knew it was a bad thing, but Abrams tried to make the best of what we had. I think some of the greatest books I've ever read in my life are Sheehan's, the trilogy that I call it, Halberstam's Best and Brightest, Sheehan's A Bright Shining Light, and I can't remember the author of the third book, but Once Upon a Distant War, about the correspondence in the, you know, the early part, the same time that Sheehan and Halberstam were over there. Totally upset by what we did. I mean, why we were there, and not why we were there, but that the leaders didn't. Honestly figure out something, didn't know what was happening, or lied, deliberately lied, like McNamara, who I hold responsible for most of the deaths of American soldiers in Vietnam. So, I mean, you know, that's how I feel about it. When the facts came out, I felt totally different than, you know, what I knew in 67, I found out I didn't know in 69 and 70 and 71, the butchery that went on. I still remember, I think General Zeiss was a commander at Hamburger Hill, and how many hundreds of Americans were slaughtered there to go up this hill for no reason at all, and he's proclaiming a great victory. And I still get upset about that to this day. I mean, you know, you're talking about a guy who made the Army a career and loved the Army, loves the Army, loves the institution, loved what he did in the Army. But as an American citizen, I cannot accept what those people did, those so-called leaders, and just upset with them.
How much is your perspective tainted by events like My Lai as well? How did My Lai affect you when it broke, and the outcome of the My Lai trials? How did they affect you as a career staff judge advocate?
On one level, what Callie did is just absolutely, you know, whatever word fits in English language, you know, it's horrible, it's disgraceful, it's abominable. But what Nixon did in basically letting Callie off the hook, maybe it only compounds it. It's not worse, but it's close. It's contemptible. The thing I'm proud of about My Lai is that when the powers that be got a hold of it, they did something about it. And they prosecuted those who they believed were responsible for it. Once you go into a courtroom, the outcome is no longer can be controlled by leadership. You know, it's an independent jury or panel or members, and that's what it was. So they found him guilty. I forgot that did they give Callie life? Yes, they did, and then it was subsequently cut down to what, about 3 years is all he served, which is a disgrace for what he did. There's no excuse. No, well, I'm not a combat soldier. I never served in combat. I mean, I've been shot at, and I had some rocket attacks, 4 or 5. But I can't accept that any pressure was so great that it would cause them to mow down women, children, and kids. That's just getting back to the Nazis, or close to them. But so that's where the travesty is, the tragedy is. But the army, the powers that be, responded appropriately, and they tried them, and you know, you accept that. I accept that, but I don't accept what Nixon did, because what Nixon did was purely political. Didn't have the guts to stand up and do the right thing.
Were there any other ways that you think the My Lai trials were important for the Army and for military justice generally?
I don't think it affected the JAG Corps itself, I can't conceive of any Army lawyer trying to hide that or push that aside or under the rug. I think the Army learned a lot from My Lai. It again revised its war crimes training. It made war crimes and law war training very important. But it gave it center stage, and it gave it some emphasis that it hadn't been doing. In fact, over the 30 years since then, they incorporate law war problems into field exercises, and they have JAGs out in the field. Mm-hmm. I say that when I was a staff judge advocate, I found that to be a waste of time. It's nice to practice law war type stuff, but when you have a daily agenda of work, that becomes a luxury, almost a luxury. When, like I was, a division SJA in Europe, having a big division and having a monster caseload, I couldn't afford that kind of time. Mm-hmm. I had daily work that had to be done. I mean, the rules of speedy trial didn't stop because I had to send some JAGs out to the field to practice law war stuff. And frankly, the law war stuff was never a great interest of mine. I mean, I was a criminal lawyer all the way, and to me, there's a difference between, well, what's right and wrong. You don't worry too, I want to put this the right way. Mm-hmm. I guess that probability of war was not significant when I was SJA. So to me, the daily work of doing criminal law was much more important than the law of war. And that's where, and when you have limited resources, you have to allocate them according to your best judgment. That's what I did. So I didn't do much in the law of war. Okay. But the Army did as an institution. Mm-hmm.
And have they picked? Do you know if they picked up, put more training in the School of Charlottesville?
Oh yes, a lot more, a lot more. The International Law Division, which trains that, has done a lot. They have greatly increased it, greatly increased it.
And is that a byproduct of the Vietnam War, do you think?
Yes.
Increasing it?
Yes. Okay. And I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah, I'm sure it is. Mm-hmm. The Army learned a lot from Vietnam. We learned a lot of things. That was one of them. We did bad things in Vietnam. We did stupid things in Vietnam. But we learned. And the leadership of the 70s, of the late 70s and 80s, shaped an army. You know, when General Abrams became the chief of staff, he started to turn the army around. And then General Meyer, and it won't be a hollow army anymore, because that's what we were after Vietnam. But the Army did a lot to be proud of. I mean, the Army that came out of Vietnam, the Army of 1970 and 71 and 72, was not the Army that fought in Desert Storm, was not created by, you know, that Army could never have done Desert Storm because they were hollow. But the leadership of the Army and of the country in the 80s, President Reagan, I think, deserves a lot of credit for this. They created the army that could use overwhelming force in the desert. Sure, we were helped by the type of terrain and enemy that we had there, but we also had the equipment and we had the power. Seventh Corps was probably the most powerful armored army ever. You know, on that 5-day battlefield, mm-hmm. that army was the strongest army, most powerful armored army ever assembled, mm-hmm. or ever, probably for the foreseeable future also. Mm-hmm. So it learned a lot of lessons from Vietnam and war crimes, war training, and law war training, certainly one of them. And Beli contributed to it, unfortunately.
You mentioned that in the questionnaire about U.S. involvement in certain places. I think if I read this correctly, the question was, what do you think about U.S. military intervention into other countries? And your response is depends on the country, the issue. Panama, you thought Panama, Grenada were good. Haiti and Bosnia and Kosovo were not very good. What were the biggest differences, and with these, from your perspective, do these involve any legal issues, or are they primarily just from the standpoint of national interest and stuff like that?
Not legally. I mean, not legal issues. Mm-hmm. It's just as an American citizen mm-hmm. taking a look at his political views. I thought that Panama with the drugs and Noriega presented mm-hmm. a distinct threat to us. Although I was, like I said, I was out of the country when that happened. I was so far out of it. We were skiing in Austria, and we're driving back home to Germany because I was stationed in Germany. What was it, 89 or 88? Mm-hmm. I don't remember which. But we're driving up the Autobahn, and I could pick up the Voice of America from Munich, and that's the first I heard about the invasion of Panama. That might have been 2 or 3 days after it happened. I thought that we went there for the right reason, and same in Grenada. They appeared to be a threat, especially with that long airfield they were building there. Somalia was ridiculous, especially when we changed the mission. Bosnia, what I would like about Bosnia is the whole way we did it. I mean, we always had the thing in the Middle East. We gave the Israelis arms, and we sold them arms and let them do their own fighting. Bosnia, we wouldn't let we wouldn't sell arms to the Muslims. They were getting murdered by the Serbs. And we sat back and did nothing. Then we went in when we should have done it. I mean, we did everything backwards there. Kosovo was just ridiculous also. Now, Haiti was absurd to put in troops into Haiti. We just, you know, the old CNN journalism. But that's, I mean, this is not from my, I'm just talking as an American citizen, yeah. A voter.
Right. What did you think about the bombing in Kosovo?
We did it the wrong way. John McCain was right. I mean, if you're going to go in and do a war, you do it. You don't pussyfoot around the way we did, extending it, high-level bombing. In fact, did you see, this week, Newsweek has a big story on the lack of effectiveness of the bombing. I was watching Hardball last night with Chris Matthews, and they had, apparently, we said at the time, we had destroyed 120 tanks, and the true number is 14 artillery pieces the same way. I mean, we did that all wrong. Bombing doesn't win wars. It never has. When we finally bombed the civilian civilian-type targets in Kosovo, we finally got somewhere. But that was another ridiculous thing. Mm-hmm. We didn't know what we were doing, and you can't. Well, this thing that you're writing your thesis on, you can't have a war without casualties. Mm-hmm. You can't do that, right. And that's what we wanted to do. Mm-hmm. But from who I consider a draft dodging president, mm-hmm. that's what I would expect.
And what are the major lessons you think we should take away from the Vietnam War?
Well, the question, I think, is really in what sphere? Militarily, we learned the lessons. the old, it's attributed to Powell, but it came from Weinberger, the 6 points of knowing what our mission is, knowing what our interests are, it goes back to Clausewitz. What are you trying to achieve? You know, and then you do it. We didn't know what we were trying to achieve. But it actually goes back to knowing what our interests are, knowing what we're trying to achieve, you know, look at the end before the beginning, and then doing it to get there as quickly and as efficiently as possible. And so, militarily we fought it all wrong, but then again, we didn't understand what the war was about. And, of course, the sanctuaries were just killed Americans and killed others. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't mean the enemy. It didn't do us any good. So from a military standpoint, we got that. From a political standpoint, again, knowing, what are we doing over there? Getting the facts. I always tell my guys, the guys who work for me, what are the facts? But we didn't know what the facts were. So, looking back on it, of course, it's hindsight now, but we didn't know anything about Vietnam. We didn't know who was fighting. Mm-hmm. And we did it all wrong, and then when we were involved in the 63 coup, that started us down the wrong road. But the politics of world politics, the Cold War, the domino theory, which was accepted, I think we learned a lot from that. I mean, we again learned, although by some of these interventions, you wonder if we really did learn, you know, what really are our interests. And, what was our interest in Somalia? I mean, you know, you don't send the military in to feed people. At least I don't think so. But that's, again, you know, those type of things. I think we hurt ourselves in the immediate years after the war. We retreated too far in some things. We did stupid witch hunts like Frank Chase, a senator from Idaho. Chase and his gutting of the CIA and going after that
Church.
Church. church, that's right. Things like that were bad, really bad isolationism. Thank goodness for Ronald Reagan. I mean, not that I agree with everything Ronald Reagan did, but he made us, from a geopolitical standpoint, I think he did great for his country. He brought us back from that. I don't know if you could get lower than we were after the war, at the end of the war, but he sure brought us back. Mm-hmm. And things like that.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to add?
I don't think so. I mean, I'm just thinking back on my experience in Vietnam. Like I said, since I was down at the bottom. I mean, I wasn't in a rice paddy, but you know, in what I did, I was down at the bottom as a trial lawyer. And, for me, it was certainly a professionally rewarding year, trying cases, trying cases. That's all I ever wanted to do. And so I got to do what I really wanted to do, and I did it in a strange place. Not a strange place, but a strange environment. Like I said, everybody's packing weapons, and everybody's. But the kinds of crimes, we got serious stuff. That was a good year. I'm glad I went there. From that point of view, I'm upset with the disillusionment that occurred as a result of what I found out. Mm-hmm. But I'm glad I went. And you asked, did it have any effect on my military career? I don't think it had any personal effect. I mean, I'm going to learn a lot about how to be a trial lawyer. Mm-hmm. But it never helped to be a Vietnam veteran, at least for assignments or for promotion. I guess if there was going to be not everybody gets promoted. So if there's ever a discriminator, I'd rather have been a served than not have served. Yeah. You know, in that respect, that's just a minor personal thing, but it meant something to me to serve, and you know, I'm glad I did. That's about it, I guess.
Okay. Well, then this ends the interview, first interview with Judge Herb Green.